Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to introduce my guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you.
You know, on our show today, Bob, we're going to be talking with Dr. Thomas Lee, Chief Medical Officer at Press Ganey, about why strategy matters now. You think that matters?
I do.
This is an important conversation about the evolving landscape of medical practice. Press Ganey is one of those things that's known to providers around the world, sometimes with a little bit of fear. We'll find out why, and hopefully it won't be so fearful.
Yeah.
But first, Bob, we've got some research that matters. We're going to be talking about statins and kind of the double-edged sword.
Testosterone supplementation, do they work?
And knee replacements, does it really help with arthritis? And I'll have something to say about that considering my recent knee escapades.
And also chickenpox vaccination, is it really a scary thing?
Well, let's talk about the first thing, about statins and potentially a double-edged sword. I love this kind of thought process, but I do think it explains perhaps maybe patients and providers. There's an increased push towards moving more people with these new guidelines to considering statins because of their really strong cardiovascular protective heart disease protective factor against if you've had some sort of heart attack, certainly. But the question is, are there some drawbacks? What does this research kind of look at?
So statins lower drugs by blocking cholesterol production in the liver, especially the bad cholesterol, and that's the good thing. And this says nobody's trying to contest whether somebody with known coronary artery disease, a history of a heart attack or diabetes ought to be on them. It's clear that they should. They do have some bad side effects that some people don't like. And, you know, memory loss, muscle problems, increasing diabetic risk for people who don't have diabetes are some of those things. But it's worth it if you have one of those aforementioned diseases.
The real question is if you do not have known coronary artery disease, but maybe you have risk factors. And that's where the kind of the controversy comes into play. And this particular article that was in the American Journal of Physiology, Cell Physiology, looks at why statins really work for those who they work for, but why they could be a problem for others.
This was done at Tulane, and they looked at a lot of patients and some basic science too, and they determined that drugs called macrophages ingest fat deposits, and when there are fat deposits in coronary artery plaques, they tend to accumulate around there and cause inflammation. And then what can happen is the plaque can rupture, blood can come out and form a clot and clog up the artery so that the downstream tissues aren't getting any oxygen.
And the long-term statin use prevented these macrophages from these certain cells in the body from turning into these macrophages. So that's the benefit. But the drawback is that they also prevented these stem cells from becoming bone and cartilage, and they increased aging and death rate of these stem cells, which could explain some of the bad news. So it maybe the whole take-home message is there's never a free lunch. Got to talk to your doctor.
And be very wary of taking them because you're going to keep from dying. You may wind up having fractures that don't heal well.
Let's talk about being wary, speaking of drugs, our next research that matters, Bob's, about testosterone supplementation. This was a research that was in a recent issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association.
And it's an actual double-blind, randomized, controlled study that wasn't huge, so there's questions it can answer, but it does give us some answers to some questions that are important to people. So this was done at the Brigham Women's Children's Hospital, 300 people, men over 60 years of age with low normal testosterone levels, were randomized into groups of 156 that got supplemental testosterone cream and people that got a gel. And interestingly, what they found out is that there was no measurable difference in atherosclerosis. They stress they can't tell whether somebody's going to have a heart attack or not, but from what they can measure, and they're measuring plaques in the carotid arteries in the neck using ultrasound, no measurable changes. Also, interestingly, they found out that there was no change in the sexual function or satisfaction of the patients either.
Yeah, sexual desire, erectile function, overall sexual function, partner intimacy scores, and health-related quality of life also didn't change. Though one thing that did change was the concentration of the red blood cell levels and the prostate PSA levels increased more in the testosterone group, both of which are probably not great overall things if there was really no benefit. So what's your take-home read thus far, Bob?
I'm pretty leery of this gel as a way to treat so-called low testosterone and have the patient get any benefit.
Unless you have proven testosterone deficiency, and that's a very small subset of all the people taking testosterone.
Right.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, and this is arthritis and the knee, something that actually means a lot to me now, Bob, recently, because I just had what's called a meniscus repair, not from arthritis, but from a basketball injury. But if I didn't get it repaired, I could have developed arthritis of my knee. Very common situation.
And I'm 20 years down the road from the same surgery, so I can add a little bit of that.
So let's talk about knee replacements. In general, Christy and I have talked a lot on this show and about that knee replacement surgery for most people is considered a major improvement of their quality of life. One of the things I think that's a question is, well, does it improve quality of life because it reduces pain, which would seem obvious, or just because you can get more mobile, but you still have pain, but you're more mobile?
And these folks were interested in what the differences in benefit were to people with so-called osteoarthritis, which is the kind I have and Adam's is very likely to get,
hey,
versus people who have rheumatoid arthritic knees. And if you do an operation and replace a knee on those two categories of folks, which one perceives the best pain relief benefit?
And basically what they looked at, and this was in the journal Arthritis and Rheumatology, was that those almost 1,000 patients with the rheumatoid arthritis and 315 patients with the osteoarthritis, looking at 6 months before and 6 months afterwards, is that the people who had the osteoarthritis really did have decreased pain that did persist. The folks with rheumatoid arthritis got improvements of pain, but you didn't completely remove, obviously, the disease process from occurring, so they got recurrence.
Yeah, so the patient's perceptions of the improvement was much better if they had the osteoarthritis.
So, now, I mean, take home for me is that it probably has some benefit potentially in multiple groups of patients here, but certainly in particularly for those with osteoarthritis.
And a caution for both kinds is you probably can't go back to your former level of athletic competition and weight bearing and long walks and all that sort of thing because the current replacement knee joints aren't designed to withstand that.
Well, and it doesn't take away that we need to, for a lot of patients, lose weight, stay physically active, better diets, lots of things like that. Our last research that matters, Bob, about chickenpox vaccination and subsequent shingles if you do or you don't get the vaccination. This was some research that really was looking at what is perhaps different in the United States, where increasingly a lot of people get the chickenpox vaccination compared to perhaps some countries where there's some concern that this is a mild childhood disease and they don't want people to get this explosion of shingles.
And they were really worried about, okay, so we give this vaccine to kids. Does that set off exacerbations in people who have had the disease before? Are they going to get shingles because their relatives or their children are getting vaccinated? And they had a good look at that. And this was done in Belgium, University of Antwerp and University of Hassel. And, you know, the bottom line was that, yeah, there is definitely an increased incidence of shingles if you start vaccinating a lot of kids. But the increased incidence is in young adults between 31 and 40, not old folks like me. And the overall was a little less among the old folks because they get a immune booster out of having exposure to that, and then they're less likely to get shingles therapeutically. Although they said that effect only lasts for 2 years, and people were thinking for years it probably would be 20.
Right. And so some of the, particularly the European countries that don't have universal childhood vaccination for things like chickenpox, may cause them to perhaps rethink in part because it's not as the consequences aren't as bad about instituting it. And so the benefits are maybe a little bit better. I think it won't change what happens in this country, and I don't think it'll change people who've refused to get the chickenpox vaccination because they're on other grounds. But all in all, a pretty interesting study.
Yes, I'd agreed, and it gave a little relief to the foreigners who want to institute the vaccine.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, Bob, we're going to be talking with Dr. Thomas Lee, Chief Medical Officer at Press Ganey, about why strategy matters now. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golsey and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, Bob, we're talking with Dr. Thomas Lee, Chief Medical Officer at Press Ganey, about why strategy matters now, the subject of a recent New England Journal of Medicine essay that he and his co-authors published.
Welcome, Dr. Lee. Thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
We're going to go over an article that was published, and it's called Why Strategy Matters Now, and you lay out a good case with 6 specific things why healthcare organizations ought to get it together and figure out who they're doing and who they're serving.
But before we get started with that, let's just talk about you a little bit. Tell us about your background, how you got into this, what some may see as a little different path as a chief medical officer at a major consulting international group.
Well, you know, I came out of medical school in 1979, and I trained in internal medicine and cardiology at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and that is, in fact, where I still practice. I switched my practice to focus on primary care even during my cardiology training, and so I've been in continuous primary care practice, you know, part-time, but continuous since 1979. And taking care of patients and trying to make my organization be successful, you know, thrive in whatever the environment was, has inevitably taken me down the road to trying to improve quality, trying to improve efficiency. And I played a major leadership role for Partners Healthcare System, the integrated system that the Brigham's part of, you know, for 18 years, 94 through 2013. It's all part of the same work, you know, trying to create an environment where we can take good care of our patients and we have the data to help us understand where we need to go and how to get there.
Nice.
You lay out these principles, the 6 different
things that can really make healthcare thrive in today's marketplace.
And I mean, to me, this reads as, let's get organized. What are we doing here? Who are we serving? What do they need? And can we build that into what we do? That's the kind of thinking here. And I guess you would maintain that that's what all healthcare organizations need to be doing.
Well, I do feel that way. And some of these things we're saying are kind of obvious. But when you're close to the work, when you're immersed in trying to get through the day or the week or the month, a lot of times you can lose track of the obvious thing. And so the title, you know, Why Strategy Matters Now, I think there are 2 key words there, you know, strategy and now. And I think that the thing I'd say about strategy is that we haven't really needed strategy, you know, up until very recently in healthcare. You know, what we needed to do was do a good job of what we were doing. And if we had good people and if we worked hard and we earned a good brand, patients would come to us. And then we could, frankly, be indispensable to the marketplace. And we could say to insurance companies, look, this is what it costs us to take care of patients, including the patients for whom we're not paid at all, or the patients for whom we're not paid enough. We need to get this from you, in order to cover our overall costs. And that's what they call cost-plus contracts. And we could pretty much get it in healthcare up until now.
But so what happened?
With changing our, I think, two or three things coming together. You know, that's the now part. And when I say now, I'm talking 2015 as opposed to 2014 or 13. We're in a very special moment. And what's happened are, first, that a real healthcare marketplace is evolving because the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. And it's forcing us, I think, I'm glad it's forcing us, but it's forcing us to figure out how do we cover more people. And to cover more people, what we're doing is we're offering a wider range of insurance products than have ever been offered before. And some of these insurance products cost less because you can't go to every healthcare provider. And when there are less expensive insurance products that have narrowed networks, people are picking them. What's happening at the same time is that middle-class budgets are pinched. You know, people are pushed to the limits with their budgets these days, and they're picking insurance products that they can actually afford. And when they're picking products that they can afford, they're often narrower network products, and it's creating pressure on providers to either be in the network or not. And they're having to look at what they do and say, can we do things differently so that we can be in the game so the patients can come to us because we're reasonably priced? And then they have to deliver excellent care because patients are picking products with networks they can afford, and then they're saying, okay, where can I get good care within the universe of providers who I can afford? That's really something new.
Right.
It creates a lot of pressure.
One of the things that you mentioned in this is value. I mean, and it's a pretty strong concept here. And I'm curious about what value it is. Is this value to the insurance industry who wants to see their patients taken care of for the money they pay us? Is this value to the patient because they're getting things done to them? Or is it the personal relationship they have and the trust they place in their physician? Or is it the value that the family doc or the cardiologist or whoever has when they're in the room?
Well, you know, and one of the things that a lot of my friends and colleagues say is that value doesn't have any definition. They don't know what value means. They don't know value to whom. I think Michael Porter and I try to be very clear. We're talking about value to patients. You know, we're talking about meeting patients' needs, doing the things that patients really care about, and doing it as efficiently as possible so that patients can afford the insurance product and can afford to come to us. So it's the patient. It's about the patient. It's not about the insurance company. It's not about the provider. It's the patient. And the patients, frankly, are paying, you know, more and more of the actual cost. That is the way we have figured out how to broaden healthcare coverage in this country. We didn't actually, you know, create Medicare for all. We are making a marketplace where patients, you know, decide where they want to go and what they want to, how much they want to spend on healthcare. That's the American way, and therefore that creates pressure on providers to improve value for patients, meet patients' needs, and do it efficiently.
You know, the times we are in are somewhat unheard of, and I think the medical students who are coming in are looking at in a different landscape in 2015, as you indicated, because it's the holy grail that you're talking about. You talked about improving value. We could talk about that quality. We could talk about reducing costs, which is part of that value equation, but it's also the satisfaction of the experience. I wonder if you can speak to that, because I think that seems to be lost sometimes, and I wonder how that plays into the work that you do. And we'll pick up on this a short answer, and then we'll pick up on it after a break.
Yeah, and I do think that we're in a special moment where I think our idealistic aspirations and business imperatives are actually converging. We all go to med school and come out of med school thinking we want to meet people's needs, and we also want to make it work for society. Now that's becoming a business imperative. You know, if organizations don't do that, they're in danger of being the last iceberg to melt.
So when you talk about this value aspect, when we come back, we'll take a short break. Maybe we can talk about some specific examples from your experience in practice. We'll talk about it, some work that's happening at UNC Family Medicine when we talk about True North. Lots of different things, and maybe you'll even give us a little clue as to what is Press Ganey for our listeners. But we're going to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Thomas Lee about why strategy matters now. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Bob, we've been talking with Dr. Thomas Lee, Chief Medical Officer at Press Ganey, about why strategy matters now. A really important essay in the New England Journal of Medicine that he and his co-authors published. And Dr. Lee, let me ask you, you're the Chief Medical Officer at Press Ganey, and Bob and I were joking before the show that Press Ganey gets more attention perhaps in our daily lives than almost anything else, perhaps even more than our wives in our medical practice. Why is that and what is it?
Well, you know, Press Ganey, you know, has a variety of different functions, but the most commonly known one is it measures patient experience, collects data from patients. It's not so much satisfaction, like how did you feel about the food or parking, that matters. It's what did patients experience? Were their needs met? Do they have peace of mind? Do they feel their care is coordinated? Those are the variables which are most important and drive how likely patients are to recommend. So I think what Press Ganey's role is in this discussion is it helps providers understand whether they're really meeting patients' real needs.
Okay. I was wondering about some of these strategies that you recommend employing and how your health center might be different from UNC Health Center Healthcare and how it's different from a mom and pop on the corner, you know? How do you see those strategies differing so that the community winds up getting taken care of?
Well, you know, the core of strategy boils down to two simple questions. You know, clarity of what you're trying to do for whom and, you know, but creating value for patients, that's what we recommend. Then the second question is, how are you going to be different? Because if you're not going to be different from everyone else, then ultimately, you know, you're going to compete on price, and price will fall, and you'll have no ability to have a margin, you know, to, you know, invest for the future. So how can you be different? Well, we think the best way to be different is to have excellent teams, you know, doctors, nurses, other kinds of personnel working really closely together to meet patients' needs. And we're not just talking about pain. We're not just talking about giving pills. We're talking about their needs for information, you know, having clarity of what's going to happen next. You know, knowing that Dr. A has talked to Dr. B and that they are in agreement. That kind of real teamwork, that's what it takes to give state-of-the-art care, and it's what it takes to give peace of mind to patients.
Well, let me ask a question. You know, what do we know about this patient satisfaction, this team-based care when we look at, you know, different cultures or different, you know, different countries? What do we know from Canada? Because what we hear, of course, is that satisfaction of care for Canadians with their own healthcare system is great, but yet their administrative expenses are far less. Is it because they're employing these strategies, or is this strategy one that's going to be unique to the U.S. for some reasons?
Well, you know, I certainly haven't been looking at, you know, a variety of nations' data. There are differences in ethnic groups. There are differences in geographic regions. But I can tell you the similarities are very clear and strong. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking inpatient, outpatient, emergency department. what matters in every sector is that patients want, they want capable clinicians, they want them to be working well together, and they want them to be listening to the patients about their real needs. You know, if they, if you've got fantastic people, but patients get the feeling that you're not actually talking to each other, that Dr. A does not know what Dr. B has done, patients don't have peace of mind. I actually think patients are smart. They're right, but those are the factors that they want in every setting. I don't think those things are going to be different in different cultures.
No, that makes perfect sense.
It seems to me that a lot of what you're talking about is particularly applicable to pretty good-sized healthcare operations, where you've got some surgeons working, some primary care people working, some specialists of various kinds, and the team aspect, and that it takes a lot of coordination to pull that off. And that's a very different thing from having a building full of family docs or a building full of pediatricians that, you know, attempt to take care of 10,000 patients or whatever.
Or a rural primary care site.
Yeah.
How's it work?
How's that going to work? How's that going to work out in East Moose Jaw, Kansas, you know?
I don't think everyone has to join one big system or a big system. But I do think you need to have relationships so that you can give your patients excellent care. And believe me, we all have a way to go on this. But, like, you know, the last patient I saw, you know, a few days ago had Parkinson's disease. I spent an hour trying to pull together the various personnel to meet that patient's needs. I didn't do a great job either. I got a lot to go back and try to pick up the pieces on. This patient ideally should be cared for by a multidisciplinary team focused on Parkinson's. Now, if you go to the Netherlands, you know, a whole country, every Parkinson's patient is cared for by a Parkinson's team, and all those Parkinson's teams work together. They share guidelines, they look at data, they learn from each other. The same is true for diabetes in the Netherlands. Now, you know, there are rural parts of the Netherlands and there are urban parts of the Netherlands, but they can channel patients toward these teams. I think we can do that in this country, but we just have to commit to doing the best possible thing for patients.
You know, one of the things that's sort of innovative that I know is Mayo and how they handle these patients that come up to their operation in Minnesota. And they'll bring a patient up for a day and they'll work the doctors around that patient. And the patients love that. It's pretty efficient for their time. And I guess there's a heck of a coordinator that's doing that with the physicians at the operation. Do you have any experience with that?
I think Mayo does a whole lot of things right. And, you know, and I think the reason they do is because they have clarity on who they're trying to serve. And, you know, everyone at the Mayo says the needs of the patient come first, because that's what one of the Mayo brothers said 100 years ago. And they're holistic. They're not just doing operations. If you have breast cancer, the breast cancer team has primary care physicians on it. They've got family practitioners on it, because they know these women are not just coming up there with breasts with cancer in it, that they have other organs, that they have brains, and they've got psychological stress, and they are trying to be holistic in taking care of the patient. And that is not the way all of U.S. healthcare is currently organized to do.
Far from it.
You know, as we're thinking about wrapping up a little bit, it seems like we're almost like back to the future a little bit, because it seems like a lot of what you described, Dr. Lee, is really how people want medicine to be practiced and how we perhaps think it could have been practiced at a day and age in the somewhat distant past. But yet the future seems threatening to so many learners and perhaps patients alike. What's your advice for really navigating not just the reduced quality and also increasing quality and reducing expense, but increasing both patient and provider satisfaction, increasing compassionate care? How's it going to work?
Well, I'm actually just finishing, you know, a book which will come out this fall called An Epidemic of Empathy in Healthcare. It's, you know, how can we use social network science to make empathic care the norm rather than the exception? And I think there's a lot we can do. I think it involves committing to meeting the needs of patients as the overall number one goal. They are what healthcare is about. Is measuring how we're doing in meeting those needs. And then it's using social network science to make empathic care the norm. Transparency about patient experience turns out to be a much more powerful driver of making empathic care the norm than financial incentives could ever do.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by the transparency of that? What's that mean?
Well, you know, like the, you know, University of Utah Healthcare led the way of collecting patient experience data from every patient they could using email and e-survey, not just on samples, but all patients, and then just putting all of the comments and online on their Find a Doctor site. Now, you know, if you go to your region, you go to Piedmont, you go to Wake Forest, and you go to their Find a Doctor sites, you're going to find every comment from every patient there. And what the impact of that on doctors is tremendous. They realize with every patient, you know, their job is to be the kind of physician the patient is hoping for. It doesn't take more time. It takes the focus and the energy. And the business rewards are actually pretty impressive, but it's the satisfaction and pride. You don't have to go very far from where you are to find out about it.
Well,
so this trend is powerful.
We've certainly got that old thing about be glad you're born and interesting times happening, because we're going to be seeing a lot of things happening. We've really enjoyed the conversation with you, Dr. Lee, and we appreciate your making yourself available to us.
Thank you very, very much.
We've been talking with Dr. Thomas Lee, Chief Medical Officer at Prescani, about why strategy matters now. Coming up on House Calls, we'll answer questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Wyther.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your questions and concerns.
And Bob, if our listeners have a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question about a topic very appropriate, someone whose son is heading back to college.
Our oldest son is leaving for college next weekend. He's going out of state and will be a few hours away, so we won't be able to come and get him and bring him home fast if he gets sick. What are some things I can do, suggest that he do, or pack to make sure that he stays healthy at school?
Well, I'd start by saying that, having sent two kids to college and advise a whole lot of patients on this, that you can send him off with a little kit. Got some Band-Aids, maybe a couple of ACE wraps.
First aid kit.
Yeah, and maybe some topical antibiotics, that sort of stuff that he can have in the room. I think they ought to investigate and see if they've got a college health service that's got hours that they can go get seen if they get ill. If not, they need a connection with a private physician.
Can they put the college logo on the first aid kit, Bob?
They probably could. But I think the reality of things is that you very much benefit from spending some quality time talking about sexually transmitted diseases prevention with your children who are going to high school. And be sure that they understand the benefit of using condoms, and I'd probably buy a box and send it with them. So, because there have been people who said, well, we got our bad disease because we were afraid to ask for condoms in the grocery store.
And two other things I'd add to what I think is a great list, Bob. Certainly for most all women, maybe most all men, I'd have a discussion about sexual trauma, bullying, and other elements that lead to particularly and associated with alcohol. But, you know, any unwanted sexual advances is such a problem on college campuses. We hear about it, but yet it can still happen. And then alcohol use in general, probably the number one risk factor for them dying on that college campus. We've had some tragedies in the University of North Carolina, people getting in a car and drinking and driving and killing people. These are such serious issues. I don't know what the little kit that goes with that, but I think a serious note, letting them know you care and talking about it over and over.
And I just to finish, I think that the boys ought to participate in the birth control, not just the girls. I mean, they got to have a sense of responsibility about future lives they're generating.
But other than that, we want your child to have a good time.
Amen.
I will say I love it when I sometimes get a call from a parent asking me if their child needs something. Would I be willing to see them? So establishing contact perhaps with a family doctor or primary care physician in case they need it in student health, they need something more than that. Thanks so much for that question. Daniel, what's our very next house call about physical activity and Fitbits?
Several of my friends recently bought Fitbits or similar physical activity monitoring gadgets. Ever since, they have been obsessed with reaching their 10,000 steps for the day and who is getting the most steps. My question is, when did steps become the universal indicator for good exercise? I have arthritis in my knee, so I don't move around all that well. Is there something like steps that I can be keeping track of to make sure that I'm getting enough activity?
Well, I think you can keep track of your pulse when you're exercising, which you should try to do 5 to 7 days a week for 30 minutes. And you can take your own pulse, and if you get it up over 100 or 110, you're doing yourself very good, and it's a data point that you can write down and get obsessed about, like your friends are about their Fitbit information.
I think the time that it became so chic to count your steps is when we had devices that could count your steps, and there is money to be made for it. It turns out most Fitbits aren't really used very long, and they sit around, and there's a secondary market, I think, overseas for sending these out. The key is staying physically active, and it can be all kinds of things. Swimming's what a great activity for someone. And we don't talk about counting your strokes, but boy, I think you can get stroke for stroke more than the walk for walk for a lot of people.
And folks with arthritic knees can get on elliptical trainers that are very low impact, and some of them can do that. Rowing can be good if you don't have arthritis in your back. And I think, like Adam mentioned, swimming is a wonderful exercise for someone with knee trouble.
Daniel, what's our very last house call?
I donate blood a few times per year. I feel like it's a pretty easy way to potentially save a life. But I went to my hospital last week to donate and they turned me away because they were concerned about malaria. I went on a rainforest hiking trip in Costa Rica 2 months ago, but I finished all of my anti-malarials and I feel fine. But they say I still have to wait a year until I can donate again. Why is that?
So I think you can rest assured that you're probably going to be just fine. You got to realize the Red Cross is in a really different place than in any individual because they've got to be so conservative that nothing bad could happen because they can get sued for it if it happens. So you were in Costa Rica and you could have been bit by a mosquito with malaria parasites in it, and it's just taking its good old time building up in your body. And that's what they're saying. We can't take your blood for a year and then we'll be sure, absolutely sure.
Yeah, you know, when you're giving blood, there's certain things they can't check for. One's an infection for an organism that the blood's not tested, like malaria. You could be exposed to medication that could be, you know, passed through to that could be, you know, cancer causing, like isotretinoin, or you could have a theoretical risk, like if you had cancer. So these are things that they're trying to reduce the risk. All wise. I'm not even certain if you actually have to take malaria pills if you go to Costa Rica, maybe in the rainforest, but we'll ask maybe our health sciences librarians to put up some links on that. It's always a good thing to review. Well, that'll conclude the house calls for today, and we want to thank all of you for joining us for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can share your questions and story by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search for our health app.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther. We look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.